Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, October 26, 2021. Snapchat, TikTok, and YouTube executives promising Congress to work on new requirements for the social media industry to protect the physical and mental health of young users. An FDA advisory committee unanimously recommending emergency authorization of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for children 5 to 11 years old. More promises of a deal near on the big social spending bill between progressive and moderate Democrats as negotiations intensifying at the White House. This is less than 2 days before President Joe Biden goes on an overseas trip that will include a stop at the climate conference in Scotland. And Virginia governor's election coming up fast, polls showing a very tight race between Democrat Terry McAuliffe and Republican Glenn Youngkin. We'll talk about it with Larry Sabato, director of University of Virginia Center for Politics. This from the Washington Post. TikTok, Snapchat, and YouTube, all social media sites popular with teens and young adults, faced a barrage of questions and accusations Tuesday from lawmakers who want the companies to do more to protect children online. Executives from all three companies committed to sharing internal research on how their products affect kids, an issue that has come to the forefront in the past several weeks as tens of thousands of pages of Facebook's internal documents have been revealed by a whistleblower. Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat from Connecticut, chairs the Senate Subcommittee on Consumer Protection that held this hearing. Here's his questioning to Jennifer Stout from Snap, Michael Beckerman from TikTok, and Leslie Miller from YouTube.
As you know by now, in August, Senator Blackburn and I wrote to Facebook asking whether they had done any research, whether they had any facts that showed harm to children. In effect, they denied it. They dodged the question. They disclaimed that Instagram is harmful to teens. Let me ask you, and I think it's pretty much a yes or no question, the same question that we asked Facebook. Have any of your companies conducted research on whether your apps can have a negative effect on children's or teens' mental health or well-being, and whether your apps promote addiction-like use? Have you done that research? Ms. Stout?
Senator, we have conducted research. Much of our research is focused on our products and how we can improve our products and services to really meet the needs of our users and our community. And as I mentioned in my opening testimony, some of the research that we did shows that 95% of users say that Snapchat makes them happy.
Will you make that research available to the subcommittee?
Yes, Senator, we would.
Mr. Beckerman?
Senator, thank you for the question. We believe that research should be done in a transparent way. And for us, we partner with external experts and stakeholders to get their feedback. And we think that this is something that everybody can work together on. And additionally, we've actually supported passage of the CAMERA Act, which would have additional funding at NIH, and we'd love to see this done in an external way, in a transparent way.
Ms. Miller?
Yes, Senator. We work with experts to leverage their insights and research to make sure that our product and policy decisions are up to date based on their insights.
Now, I've asked whether the research has been done that could show negative effects or addictive-like impacts. You've all indicated that you've done that research, and Ms. Stout has indicated that her company will make it available. I'm assuming, Mr. Beckerman, your company will? You're nodding. And Ms. Miller?
Yes, Senator, we have published some research, and we would make additional available.
Questions from Senator Richard Blumenthal to the vice presidents of YouTube, TikTok, and Snap Incorporated, parent company of Snapchat. Senator today citing examples of harm done to young people on these sites, including the promotion of eating disorders, drug addiction, or sexually explicit content. Senator Ed Markey, Democrat from Massachusetts, asking the witnesses if they support his proposed bill to give new privacy rights to children, ban targeted ads, and video autoplay aimed at kids.
The problem is clear. Big tech preys on children and teens to make more money. Now is the time for the legislative solutions to these problems. And that starts with privacy. I've introduced bipartisan legislation to give children and teens a privacy bill of rights for the 21st century. Today, a 13-year-old girl on these apps has no privacy rights. She has no ability to say no. No, you can't gobble up data about me. No, you can't use that data to power algorithms that push toxic content towards me. No, you can't profile me to manipulate me and keep me glued to your apps. No, you have no rights. 13-year-old girl in the United States of America in the year 2021. My bipartisan Children and Teens Online Privacy Protection Act gives 13, 14, and 15-year-olds that right to say no. To each witness, do you support my legislation to update the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act to give that 13, 14, and 15-year-old control of their data? Ms. Stout.
Senator Markey, I just want to say that we absolutely support a federal privacy proposal, and we've worked very hard with members of this body to try to...
Do you support my child protection, my teen protection law?
So, Senator, we agree that there should be additional protections put against young people to protect them further from...
Right. Yeah, so you've had a chance to look at the Child Online Privacy Protection update that I've introduced. It's been out there for years. Do you support it or not?
I think, Senator, we'd love to talk to you a bit more about some of the issues.
Listen, this is just what drives us crazy. We want to talk. We want to talk. We want to talk. This bill's been out there for years, and you still don't have a view on it. Do you support it or not?
I think there are things that we would like to work with you on, Senator.
Listen, this is just the old game. Mr. Beckerman, do you support the Child Online Privacy Protection Act being updated the way my legislation does?
Senator, thank you for your leadership on this issue. It's been very important. Yes, we agree that COPPA needs to be updated, particularly as it relates to the way age verification happens across the Internet. It's an area that I think has been not given as much attention as it deserves, but we do agree that COPPA does need to be updated.
Do you support my legislation to update it? You've had plenty of time to look at it.
We like your approach. However, I think a piece that should be included is a better way to verify age across the Internet, across apps, rather than the system that is in place now. And I think with that improvement, it would be something that we'd be happy to support.
Okay. Ms. Miller.
Senator, we also support the goals of updated comprehensive privacy legislation on your specific bill. I know we've had conversations with your staff in a constructive manner, and I would welcome continuing to do that.
Questioning to the executives from Snap, TikTok, and YouTube by Senator Ed Markey at today's hearing. Another issue that came up involved TikTok and its relationship with its owner, Chinese company ByteDance. As Channel News Asia explains, former President Donald Trump had sought to bar TikTok, a popular platform used by millions of Americans, from U.S. app stores, saying it collected data from American users that could be obtained by China's government and posed a threat to U.S. national security. Democratic President Joe Biden later revoked Trump's plan but sought a broader review of various foreign-controlled apps. Back to the hearing, subcommittee ranking Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee pressing TikTok's Michael Beckerman.
Mr. Beckerman, I want to come to you first. In the past, TikTok has said that it has never, nor would it ever, share and provide user data to the Chinese government, even if asked. Yet your privacy policy says you can disclose data collected to respond to government inquiries. It also says you share data you collect with your parent companies and affiliates, and that you transmit user information to servers and data centers overseas. And earlier this year, the Chinese Communist Party acquired an ownership stake and a seat on the board of ByteDance. So, does TikTok share user data with its parent company, ByteDance?
Thank you, Senator. This is an important question, and I'm glad you're asking. TikTok does not...
Quickly.
Excuse me?
Quickly, please.
Yes, Senator. We do not share information with the Chinese government, and I would like to point you to a Citizen Lab report, which is one of the most well-respected global national security experts, where they said Our research shows that there's no overt data transmission to the Chinese government, and our testing TikTok did not contact any servers within China. And then the report goes on to state, Senator, that TikTok does not pose a threat to national security, and I'd be happy to submit that report for the record.
Okay, let me ask you, please submit the report for the record. Do any ByteDance employees have access to TikTok user data or any role in creating their algorithm?
Senator, U.S. user data is stored in the United States. Our backups are in Singapore, and we have a world-renowned U.S.-based security team that handles access to user data.
I understand that you say you store it in Singapore. Tell me about programmers, product developers, and the data teams. Are they housed in China?
Senator, like many technology companies, we have engineers in the United States and throughout and around the world.
And so they have access to algorithms and data.
Senator, we have engineers in the United States, and we also have engineers.
So that answer is yes. What about Douyin? ByteDance says they are fully separate, but do Douyin employees have any access to TikTok user data or input into the algorithm?
Senator, that's a completely different app from TikTok. And
no, it's a related company. You might want to check that. If the Chinese Communist Party asks you for U.S. user data, what is to stop you from providing it since they have a seat on the board of ByteDance and they have a financial stake in the company?
Senator, that's not accurate. One, they do not have a stake in TikTok at all.
They do. It happened in August.
Senator, that's not
that
accurate.
That is ByteDance. And we can clarify that for the record. But the record is that the Chinese Communist Party acquired a stake in ByteDance in August, and they now have a seat on the board.
Senator Marsha Blackburn questioning Michael Beckerman, TikTok vice president and head of public policy for the Americas. You can find the full Senate subcommittee hearing at our website, cspan.org. TikTok says it has more than 1 billion monthly users. Snapchat, also testifying today, says it has 500 million monthly active users. And a YouTube executive testifying, billions of videos on that site watched every day. Also today, the Federal Communications Commission voting to revoke authorization for China Telecom's U.S. subsidiary to operate in the U.S., citing national security concerns. China Telecom is the largest Chinese telecommunications company. It's provided services in the U.S. for nearly 20 years through China Telecom Americas, but it must now discontinue within the U.S. within 60 days. This is Washington Today. From NBC News, a smaller dose of Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine cleared its first regulatory hurdle Tuesday for use in young children after a Food and Drug Administration advisory committee voted to recommend it for emergency use authorization for those ages 5 to 11. The 17-0 vote with one abstention will now go to the FDA, which is expected to make a final ruling in the coming days. If authorized, the move would make nearly the entire U.S. population eligible for COVID shots. Only children ages 4 and younger would remain ineligible. NBC News adds this, despite the vote in favor, deciding whether the benefits of vaccination for young kids outweigh potential risks appear to weigh heavily on the advisors. Some of today's proceedings, Dr. Doran Fink, Deputy Director of the FDA's Division of Vaccines, set the stage Tuesday morning.
As we all know, the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID vaccine is authorized for use under EUA in individuals 12 years of age and older, and additionally is approved under the trade name Comirnaty for use in individuals 16 years of age and older for active immunization for prevention of COVID-19 caused by the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Pfizer-BioNTech has now submitted a request seeking an amendment to their EUA for use of a two-dose primary series in children 5 through 11 years of age. This request includes use of a lower mRNA content, 10 micrograms, than authorized for use in older age groups, 30 micrograms. That is, we are considering the use of an age-appropriate dose level because, as we pediatricians are fond of saying, children are not simply small adults. The VRBPAC is convened today to discuss whether available data support that the benefits of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine outweigh its risks when administered as a two-dose primary series to children 5 through 11 years of age.
Dr. Doran Fink from the FDA at the start of today's advisory panel virtual meeting. Later in the proceedings, Dr. William Gruber from Pfizer made the company's case for approving the emergency use authorization.
I am pleased to present to you today the Pfizer-BioNTech BNT162b2 vaccine request for emergency use authorization in individuals 5 to less than 12 years of age. My name is Bill Gruber, and I head the Vaccine Clinical Research and Development Group at Pfizer. My presentation this morning will be brief and to the point. Although I will touch on each of the topics shown here, I will focus primarily on the clinical data that demonstrates clear and compelling vaccine safety and efficacy and supports an emergency use authorization in 5 to less than 12-year-olds. Pfizer-BioNTech are seeking emergency use authorization of a 10 microgram dose of BNT162b2 for use in children 5 to less than 12 years of age. A lower dose of 10 microgram was selected as the optimum dose for 5 to less than 12 years of age based on the favorable reactogenicity profile and robust immunogenicity results from a dose finding and phase 2-3 study. The proposed indication is for the active immunization to prevent COVID-19 caused by SARS coronavirus 2 in individuals 5 to less than 12 years of age, administered as a primary series of two doses of 0.2 milliliters each, 3 weeks apart. I will share information with you today that the vaccine meets emergency use authorization guidance for children 5 to less than 12 years of age. You will see that the vaccine meets all safety data expectations and meets immunobridging criteria, and that 90.7% efficacy was observed. Plans are established for active follow-up of safety under emergency use authorization, and the vaccine's benefits outweigh its risks.
Dr. William Gruber, Senior Vice President, Vaccine Clinical Research and Development at Pfizer Incorporated, at today's FDA advisory panel meeting, which again voted unanimously, one abstention, to approve the emergency use authorization. Next stop is the full FDA. Next week, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Advisory Committee will meet. And if they approve it, it's off to Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the CDC director, final step before the children ages 5 to 11 can get the vaccine. The Biden administration says it's purchased enough vaccine and set out the plans to vaccinate all 28 million children in that age group. More from the NBC article. They write, like in adults, the full vaccination series consists of two doses given 3 weeks apart. The children's doses will come in vials with an orange cap and an orange label. The doses for adults and teens come in vials with a purple cap and a purple label. Also, though children are less susceptible to severe illness from COVID, more than 1.9 million children ages 5 to 11 have tested positive for the coronavirus over the course of the pandemic, and more than 8,400 have been hospitalized. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the new C-SPAN Now app, wherever you get your podcasts. A few more headlines. Justice Department says law enforcement officials in the U.S. and Europe have arrested 150 people and seized more than $31 million and 45 firearms in an international drug trafficking investigation stemming from the sale of tens of thousands of illegal drugs on the darknet. That's part of the internet hosted within an encrypted network accessible only through specialized anonymity-providing tools. And the White House has nominated the acting Federal Communications Commission Chair, Jessica Rosenworcel, to permanently head the agency. And also nominated Gigi Sohn, a fellow at the Georgetown Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy, to become a commissioner. If both nominees are confirmed, it would give Democrats a 3-2 majority on the FCC. This from Politico. The White House hosted last-minute meetings with influential groups of House Democrats on Tuesday as party leaders in both chambers raced to resolve disagreements still snarling President Joe Biden's domestic agenda. Even as they get closer to agreement with Senate centrist holdouts on their social spending mega bill, Democrats face hang-ups over major issues that include taxes, Medicare and Medicaid expansion, and paid leave, all of which are in flux as lawmakers keep negotiating As talks drag on, party leaders are still sounding confident. Well, many of the House progressives meeting with President Biden at the White House today, they include members of the Tri-Caucus, Women's Caucus, and LGBTQ plus Equality Caucus. And as they walked in, reporters asking if a deal was close.
Thank you.
Will you still approve?
How close are you?
Answers of today to those shouted questions from at least one or two House Democrats walking into the White House. This all comes ahead of President Biden's trip overseas starting Thursday, a stop in Scotland for the annual climate conference. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan asked today how important it is to get a final agreement on at least that part of the big bill, climate change programs, before the president departs.
Just broadly speaking, as we're now looking roughly 48 hours before the president lands here, you just said the president intends to make good on these commitments as they relate to climate change. How important is it, in your view, that he lands in Europe with this deal secured here at home as it relates to climate change in terms of convincing allies that he will make good on this promise?
I think what the allies are looking at is the effort that President Biden has undertaken to design and now negotiate an ambitious, effective, practical set of investments in climate and clean energy and infrastructure and economic growth in the United States. They're excited about it. They raise it when we see them. When we see our counterparts, they raise it with him. They want to see the United States making these investments. They also recognize that the United States has a set of democratic institutions, has a Congress, that this is a process that it needs to be worked through. And so I believe that whether there is a deal this week or whether the negotiations continue, there will be a lot of energy and enthusiasm for the effort the president is undertaking right now to make bold, far-reaching investments that will deliver on his commitments, both with respect to climate and with respect to economic growth in the United States.
Do you not see this as his credibility weakened if he shows up there without a deal reached?
I think you've got a sophisticated set of world leaders who understand politics in their own country and understand American democracy and recognize that working through a complex, far-reaching negotiation on some of the largest investments in modern memory in the United States, that takes time. And so I don't think that world leaders will look at this as a binary issue. Is it done? Is it not done? They'll say, is President Biden on track to deliver on what he said he's going to deliver? And we believe one way or the other, he will be on track to do that.
That's National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan in the White House briefing room. A new poll showing 55% of Americans want Congress to pass a bill to ensure that more of the nation's electricity comes from clean energy and less from climate-damaging coal and natural gas. 16% of Americans opposed that poll from AP, NORC, EPIC. And Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, one of the two Senate Democrats whose votes are needed to pass anything and who have been demanding that the reconciliation spending bill be pared back on such things as the climate change programs that have been proposed. Also, a proposed new expansion of Medicare. Joe Manchin saying on Monday, my big concern right now is the 2026 deadline for Medicare insolvency. And if no one's concerned about that, I've got people that's a lifeline. Medicare and Social Security is a lifeline for people back in West Virginia, most people around the country. You've got to stabilize that first before you look at basically expansion. So if we're not being fiscally responsible, that's a concern. The quote from Senator Joe Manchin. Today, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, leader of the Senate Progressives, put down his own marker on this.
If you ask the American people today what is most important to them, they're going to say two things. Number one, they're sick and tired of being ripped off by the pharmaceutical industry. They think that it's insane that in some cases we pay 10 times more for the same drug as the people in other countries, while last year the pharmaceutical industry made $50 billion in profit and right now has 1,500 paid lobbyists here in Washington to make sure we don't lower the cost of the prescription drugs. So to my mind, any serious reconciliation bill must include real Medicare negotiations with the pharmaceutical industry to lower the cost of prescription drugs. That's probably the issue most on people's minds. Maybe the issue second most on people's minds is the understanding that it is really insane that in the wealthiest country in the history of the world, We have tens of millions of Americans, older Americans, who have no teeth in their mouth, who are unable to digest the food that they're eating, people who cannot hear and communicate with their grandkids because they have no hearing aids, people who are unable to see. Well, this is America, richest country in the history of the world. Bottom line is that any reconciliation bill must include serious negotiations on the part of Medicare with the pharmaceutical industry, lower the cost of the prescription drugs. That's what the American people want. Any serious reconciliation bill must include expanding Medicare to cover dental, hearing aids, and eyeglasses.
Is that a red line for you? Is that a red line for you, sir? Sir, is that a red line for you?
Senator Bernie Sanders, the Budget Committee Chair, speaking with reporters on Capitol Hill. He's an independent from Vermont, caucuses with the Democrats. Senator Joe Manchin, who had laid out that statement about Medicare that Senator Bernie Sanders responded to, had a very high-profile meeting with President Joe Biden at the president's home in Delaware this past weekend about the big spending bill. Senator Manchin talking about it today at the Economic Club of Washington.
Did you leave thinking that we're making progress and that you said to the president, well, here's my bottom line, and if you can deliver this, you got my vote?
I don't think you negotiate. No one should ever negotiate with the president, especially, or anyone else if you're negotiating in good faith. Yeah, I've always tried to put myself in the other person, but I want the other person to understand who I am, too. So if they can put themselves where I am and I put mine, we reverse roles and look at it. So when I left, I think it was a very positive meeting. We know there's a lot of things we can do to make more perfect union.
Okay. When you go to the president's house like that, I guess you can ask for anything you want to eat, and they serve anything, right? Because they want to make you happy, right? So you had a good time.
Well, let me tell you, the thing we had a good time was, as you know, I kidded him. You know how he was always supposed to be the poor senator. He had an eye for real estate. So I told him, I said, Mr. President, you didn't do too bad for a poor senator. But let me tell you one thing he did. And we talked about that, and you walked down. But he built the home, and I was very impressed. He did a heck of a job, and he designed the whole thing. We went through it. It's a very nice home and a very nice setting. And he has some neighbors, and one neighbor is not of his political persuasion. And if he's 4 inches over, if a car parks 4 inches over, then sometimes he hears about it.
Even when he's president of the United States?
Oh, right now, more so when he's president, yeah.
So when you're negotiating with him or meeting with him, are you kind of representing Senator Sinema, or does she represent herself?
No. I, one thing you learned about being a Senate, if you can take care of yourself, you're lucky.
Okay. So, all right. So she has her own views, and
she
you have your
her own views.
Okay.
I respect her very much, and she's a friend of mine. But, you know, I think what we bonded in, because I've been adamant, I've been there long enough to vote in 2013 against the nuclear bomb, getting rid of the filibuster that when at that time Senator Harry Reid did. And then in 2017 when Mitch McConnell did it for Supreme Court. And I've been very steadfast on that. And then to find out I have another person who feels as strong as I do was welcome.
Senator Joe Manchin with Economic Club of Washington President David Rubenstein. Senator Manchin also saying during this event that a proposal to increase tax enforcement at the IRS by requiring banks to report new data on accounts to the agency is unlikely to be in a final compromise budget reconciliation package. That provision on the IRS has been heavily criticized by Republicans. On Wall Street, the Dow up 15, NASDAQ up 9, S&P up 8. This from FoxNews.com. The Pentagon stated Tuesday that nearly 450 American citizens are still in Afghanistan following August U.S. military withdrawal, more than the Biden administration had previously claimed. The latest tally came from Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Colin Call after Senator Jim Inhofe, Republican from Oklahoma, pointed to what he believed were contradictory or at least confusing numbers that the administration has presented since the August 31st withdrawal. Call testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee, along with Lieutenant General James Mingus, Joint Chiefs of Staff Operations Director. Here's a portion where they're asked about the effects, the after effects of the Afghanistan withdrawal on U.S. national security by Senator Joni Ernst, Republican from Iowa.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and gentlemen. Thank you for being here today as we continue to examine the repercussions of President Biden's disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan and the abandonment of Americans to the hands of the Taliban. Dr. Call, is it true that President Biden said we wouldn't leave when there were Americans left behind?
We have not left Americans behind. They continue to get out.
We left Americans behind.
We did not leave Americans behind. They continue to get out.
Did the DOD, you represent the DOD, Dr. Call, did the DOD leave before all Americans were out?
It was the consensus judgment that leaving on August 31st was the best way to continue.
So the DOD, General Mingus, did the DOD, did our soldiers leave before all Americans were out?
Yes, ma'am. The last airplane left the evening of the 30th, morning of the 31st of August.
Thank you for your straightforward answer, General Mingus. Dr. Call, is there more or less risk of terror attacks against Americans and American interests because of the precipitous withdrawal of American military capability from the region?
I think the intelligence community assesses that the overall risk to the homeland across the world is at its lowest point since 9/11. We've already discussed the possibility that ISIS-K and al-Qaeda could reconstitute, and we have to be vigilant against that in Afghanistan.
That does not sound like a low risk when you have just told us that the possibility of attack from ISIS-K to our homeland could be 6 to 12 months from now.
The intelligence community assesses they could build that capability. We need to be vigilant in disrupting that.
So it doesn't sound like low risk. So, Dr. Call, what threat assessments did you use for planning the security environment that would occur after the U.S. withdrawal? What assessments?
Well, when I came into office, the decision had already been made, and I was overseeing, from a civilian perspective, the retrograde operations.
Colin Call is Defense Undersecretary for Policy, testifying along with Lieutenant General James Mingus from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Operations Director. Questions from Senator Joni Ernst, Republican from Iowa, today's Armed Services Committee hearing. The House this week unanimously passed a bill to posthumously award the Congressional Gold Medal to the 13 U.S. troops killed in the terror bombing outside the Hamid Karzai International Airport in Kabul in August. That legislation now heads to the Senate. Virginia governor's election is 1 week and 1 day away, November 2nd. A new USA Today Suffolk University poll showing it's too close to call. Democrat Terry McAuliffe and Republican Glenn Youngkin tied at about 45% each. In just a moment, we'll be talking with political analyst Larry Sabato. First, here are some of the many ads now running in Virginia.
What's the Virginia governor's race really about? You. Us. It's about who we are. The choice is stark. Glenn Youngkin is Donald Trump's candidate. Anti-Semitism. Racism. Denying gay couples the right to marry. That ugly Charlottesville hate. Terry McAuliffe believes in a different Virginia. Working together, rejecting hate. Which Virginia do you believe in? Don't let Donald Trump win.
The Lincoln Project paid for and is responsible for the content of this advertising.
As a parent, it's tough to catch everything. So when my son showed me his reading assignment, my heart sunk. It was some of the most explicit material you can imagine. I met with lawmakers. They couldn't believe what I was showing them. Their faces turned bright red with embarrassment. They passed bills requiring schools to notify parents when explicit content was assigned. It was bipartisan. It gave parents a say, the option to choose an alternative for my children. I was so grateful. But then Governor Terry McAuliffe vetoed it twice. He doesn't think parents should have a say. He said that. He shut us out. Glenn Youngkin, he listens. He understands. Parents matter. Join me in voting for Glenn Youngkin.
I'm Glenn Youngkin, candidate for governor, and I sponsored this ad.
With more on the Virginia gubernatorial election, we're joined by Larry Sabato, director of the University of Virginia's Center for Politics and editor-in-chief of Sabato's Crystal Ball Political Newsletter. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
What is the state of this race?
It is very close and very competitive, and I don't think it's where a lot of people, certainly on the Democratic side, expected it to be a week ahead of the election.
One signature issue for each side, what would you say it is?
For the Democratic side, it would have to be that the Republican is Trumpy, at least in some ways, and Virginia solidly rejected Trump twice in 2016 and 2020. The idea being, you've never had it so good, you better keep voting Democratic. For the Republican side, there have been many issues that I think they've tried in order to get Terry McAuliffe on the defensive. The one they've settled on is education, particularly secondary school education and some primary. And that's because there's a lot of turmoil about mask requirements and vaccine requirements and books in the libraries that may have obscene parts. And you name it, it's happening. And we see it at school board meetings with angry crowds showing up and making threats. They're not making threats, but they're capitalizing on the emotion that exists in the localities about how the schools are being run.
Terry McAuliffe has been bringing in a number of superstars, former President Obama, President Biden. What does that say about where he is in the race?
Democrats lack some of the enthusiasm that Republicans have been displaying, mainly because Republicans have been out of power for 10 years. They've lost every election in Virginia for every statewide office, so they want to win, and they're charged up, ready to go. Democrats maybe are sated by success. They may be unhappy that Democrats in Washington can't get their act together and pass the big bills that Biden and the Democrats promised them. And so what McAuliffe has been forced to do is to bring in the reinforcements, President Obama and Vice President Harris, President Biden twice, Stacey Abrams from Georgia, loads of other people, to try to get Democrats and especially minority voters, especially black voters, engaged in the campaign. Because without a big turnout of minorities, a Democrat, even in Virginia, cannot win.
Any big-name surrogates showing up for Glenn Youngkin?
He has tried to make a virtue of the fact that there really isn't anybody that he can invite in who is both popular in Virginia and well-known. You can imagine how the campaign has been sweating out Donald Trump, but deciding to fly in. They do not want Trump here. Vice President Pence is coming in and is speaking to a group of Republicans who strongly endorse Youngkin, but they've gone to great pains to make it clear that Youngkin did not invite Pence and won't be there. And it's like that for a whole series of people in the convention. Youngkin did invite Republicans like Senator Ted Cruz in, for example, their personal friends. But we see none of that for the general election, and it's a wise strategy because Virginia, while not solidly Democratic, is kind of bluish purple or purplish blue. It leans more Democratic than Republican.
We're talking with Larry Sabato from the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Early voting in Virginia has been going on for a couple of weeks. Can any trend be gleaned in the race for governor based upon the numbers of votes coming in?
Yeah, we don't register by party in Virginia, so you really can't do what people in other states can do, see how many Democrats are voting and how many Republicans. But based on what I've seen, and mainly it's the number of votes coming in from certain localities that lean one way or the other, Democrats, as expected, will have some sort of lead with the early voting. How big a lead? No one can say. No one will know until those votes are opened on election night. The number is impressive. We expect upwards of 2.5 to 3 million Virginians to vote in the gubernatorial election, and already we're at somewhere around 700,000, could be a little bit more than that now. That's lower than 2020, but of course that was at the height of the pandemic. But people have gotten used to voting early, sometimes in person early, sometimes by mail, though mail has been trailing off. It took me nearly a month to get my absentee mail ballot, and I'll never vote by mail again.
Virginia's governor race is getting a lot of attention because it is the big off-year close race, but there are some pundits that are saying it will be a bellwether for the 2020 2022 midterm elections. Will it?
The odds are it will certainly tell us some things about 2022, but it's a year away. And so how many big events will happen in the next year? We can't even count them, and we don't know what they are. So I think anybody who makes firm predictions a year ahead of an election is going to wind up with egg on his or her face quite frequently. Is there a history of Virginia being predictive? To some degree, most Virginia elections do give some indication of which way the midterm election will go. But the Virginia results really don't tell you the magnitude of victory for one party or the other. And sometimes the indicators are just wrong. Actually, the first time that Terry McAuliffe was elected governor in 2013, Democrats said, well, thank goodness, this means 2014 won't be such a bad year for us. Yeah, the Democrats lost the Senate, and the Republicans kept a large majority in the House. So, no, that wasn't an indicator at all. It was precisely the opposite.
Lavery Sapoteau is editor-in-chief of Sapoteau's Crystal Ball, director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Thank you very much.
I enjoyed talking to you.
And thanks for listening today to Washington Today. For more Washington stories delivered straight to your inbox, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word, at c-span.org/connect. And I hope you have a good night.